Hello, I'm Fred Stella. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Professor Lawrence Sager. He's the author of, among other things, Religious Freedom and the Constitution, something he co-authored with Christopher Eisberger, the current president of Princeton University. Lawrence Sager is one of the nation's preeminent constitutional theorists and scholars. He currently teaches at the University of Texas. His prior posts include New York University. He has also taught at Harvard, Princeton, Boston University, UCLA, and the University of Michigan. Professor Sager is the author or co-author of dozens of articles, many now classics in the canon of legal scholarship. He's the author of two books, Justice in Plain Clothes, A Theory of American Constitutional Practice, and the aforementioned Religious Freedom and the Constitution. We welcome once again to Common Threads, Lawrence Sager. Hello, Larry.
Hi there.
Thanks so much for joining us again after a very profound conversation last week.
My pleasure.
I'd like to start out today by asking, now, liberals tend to quote Jefferson's wall of separation, which does not appear in the Constitution, but in a letter. What is your take on that? Because the conservatives tend to say, well, there is no wall of separation in the Constitution. That shouldn't count. Could you discuss in general how legal scholars treat the extra-constitutional writings of the founders? I'm curious if judges who claim to be originalists or textualists allow for that to be considered.
So there are two questions here, how to think about the wall of separation and how to think about a letter from Thomas Jefferson as a methodological question. I think that very few constitutional scholars and judges would think that something that Thomas Jefferson said in a letter would be authority that would bind them or give them binding direction. Originalists these days, among whom I do not number, look at the text of authoritative legal documents like the Constitution and believe that they can take from the public meaning of the text direction for contemporary application. And they would not include in the range of important documents a letter from eminent and articulate a figure as Thomas Jefferson. And people whose approach to the Constitution is a more substantive one of looking to give its broad abstractions concrete contemporary moral meaning wouldn't think that something Jefferson had said bound them in any way. If the wall of so no one, I think, would say we should adopt and follow the dictates of the metaphor of a wall of separation because it's constitutional authority and binding on us. If the wall of separation metaphor is attractive and useful, it's because it illustrates what we think is the best way to think about the Constitution. And so we're drawn to its metaphorical power, but it doesn't drive us. We choose it. In effect, having said that, I'm inclined to think that the wall of separation metaphor is misleading, and that we might do best without it.
Tell us why.
Well, the wall of separation metaphor gave on when it was most prominent to two ideas. The idea was the state couldn't reach over the wall and regulate religion and religious actors. So it's a source of a special privilege for religious activity and religiously motivated individuals on the one hand. But it also, the wall of separation metaphor was used to say, in return, the state couldn't send money over the wall or other forms of support over the wall to religions. So The wall of separation metaphor, taken strictly, created a strange world in which religious activity was indefensively privileged on the one hand, in terms of being free of regulation, and indefensively starved of public support. Two forms of unjust treatment pointing in opposite directions. And by the way, there were some cases where the court couldn't even figure out whether it was, you know, whether the you must leave them alone or you must not give them money was applicable. So that in there's a famous New York case involving the a constitutional objection to a landmark preservation ordinance as applied to a prominent church, and some people said the state can't regulate the church in its decisions about building or taking down its building because that violates the wall of separation. You know, regulation can't reach religious projects. And others said the state couldn't grant an exemption to this church because they were going to use their ability to build an office building on their land to raise money. And this would be an indirect way of the state giving a special financial benefit, and it can't do that. And neither of these is a very sensible way of thinking about the appropriate and fair treatment of religion in our public life. And so the wall of separation gave on to two odd, striking forms of unequal treatment pointing in opposite directions. And I think we need to move away from both of those.
So you would certainly consider, if I'm hearing you correctly, the North Church in Boston, which clearly played a prominent role in our history, it needs some sort of renovation. It is not only a working church, it's also an historical landmark. You would support some government funds in helping maintain it?
Yes, absolutely.
And
incidentally, now, by the way, you know, the most recent pronouncements from the court, particularly from Justice Gorsuch in the Trinity Lutheran case, insisted that a church be eligible for special playground equipment benefits from the state, as opposed to being disabled as a religious entity from receiving those funds. So I strongly support the fair programs which fairly include religious enterprises among their beneficiaries, public programs. But I support the other side strongly as well, which is that I think fairly applied regulations can prevent people from pursuing some of their religious projects. I think that religion is an attractive and wonderful human activity, and it needs to be treated fairly, but not with special privilege.
So, as you know, this is Michigan. This is Betsy DeVos country here. How do you look at her goals, her mission with vouchers?
I think it's what I feel about it, vouchers is that they are very, very ill-advised, that in some circumstances they might be unconstitutional, but that in many circumstances they would be constitutional, just a very bad idea.
And what's
the Constitution doesn't protect us from all of our follies.
Give us some examples of why you think it's ill-advised.
Well, it's ill-advised because public schools perform a wonderful function, including a wonderful function of providing a kind of open, embracing, inclusive environment. We speak of them as secular, but not because they promote non-religion, but because they're really kind of open and open to people of different religious faiths. The prayer does not go on in them. Religiously specific curricula are not pursued. They're very interesting and they're very valuable. voucher arrangements are likely to further starve our public schools and are likely to promote educational divisiveness, if you will, something that we really do not need, to say the least, in our time and place. But if they are fairly applied programs, and if there are if they leave non-religious options or secular options of a completely adequate form intact, I think voucher programs are probably constitutional, which is the Supreme Court's latest word on this, by the way. I agree with that. I just think it's a very bad idea, and a bad idea on grounds that should be of interest to you and your listeners, because voucher programs are likely to encourage religious balkanization in our educational institutions, and that's a great misfortune.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of chaplains. I think that a lot of people who study the history of religion and our form of government sort of get stuck at the end, when they think of all of these founders as absolute secularists and deists, and that not many of them practiced the kind of Christianity that would be called evangelical Christianity, and yet they come up with the idea of chaplains serving in the government. Talk about that history and how we can make sense of it in the secular form of government we have.
That's a very interesting question, and I'm not sure I fully know the history and can answer the question perfectly, but let me make a couple of passes. One, on the question of the sort of secular perspective of the framing generations, who ought to be respected because they're our founders, not necessarily because they're the drafters of the Constitution, by the way. But the Constitution is a very interesting document. It is nearly unique among world constitutions in not including a single reference to God in the document itself, which is extraordinary. And that's despite the fact there's more text given over to religious freedom and non-establishment and the like than to any other liberty. But there's no reference to God, and it's hard to think that that isn't a kind of self-conscious worry the heavy hand of the state with regard to religion from a framing generation that had escaped many heavy-handed states in Europe. So that's interesting. In terms of the question of chaplains, It's a very interesting question. It's what they knew. It is a way that they expressed to themselves their solemn commitment to move ahead, and to move ahead with responsibility. It seems to me sort of benedictory statements by chaplains at the beginning of legislative sessions was in some ways a kind of solemn reminder to themselves of who they are, what their responsibilities are, and that there wasn't necessarily a convenient secular way of doing that. This is the habit of a people for expressing solemn fidelity to sober responsibility, and as such, very attractive. In other contexts, like the presidential oath, by the way, the Constitution says that the president will either swear his allegiance religiously or promise it in a secular way. There's an easy non-religious way of swearing your allegiance or making or stating your commitment. So my view of legislative chaplains is a kind of our attractive habit of reminding ourselves about going forward in a solemn and responsible way. And it's a sort of a misfortune that we don't have a secular way of doing that alternatively, but it's not a terrible cost, to say the least. Chaplains in prisons or in military settings are a very different story. And there, the thing about the military and the thing about prisons and other institutions like them is that they are totalizing experiences. You could almost say totalitarian experiences. And if the state did not provide religious leaders in these totalizing experiences, it would be intolerably depriving individuals of religious leadership. So the role of chaplains and rabbis and imams in prisons and the military is entirely understandable and laudatory. It just is important that there be, you know, as many faith says is plausible, covered, and as many, you know, religious leaders appropriate to those faiths covered. If you didn't have rabbis and imams as well as
pastors,
chaplains,
yeah, right,
pastors, you'd be you'd be committing a serious, you know, moral delict. But providing religious leadership in these totalizing experiences is not only appropriate, it may very well be obligatory.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Professor Lawrence Sager, one of the nation's preeminent constitutional theorists and scholars. He's also the co-author of Religious Freedom and the Constitution. Back to chaplains for just a minute. The court recently ruled in a way that just absolutely mystified me. It was the case where a Buddhist was sentenced to death, and the court ruled that he didn't need to see a Buddhist chaplain, and apparently there wasn't one on staff. They would have had to have found someone, but I can't fathom that that would have been much of a challenge. Do you know the reasoning behind the majority opinion?
I don't, and I'm not sure I know the case well, but if it is as you described it, it's simply wrong. I agree with you. I can't fathom it either.
Yeah.
It may have been a situation where the court declined at the last minute to intervene in an execution because the court is exhibiting this kind of callous impatience towards capital punishment interventions in some instances. But on the merits, your instincts strike me as absolutely right.
You say that the Supreme Court often yields results under the theory of equal liberty, which is what you subscribe to. Two exceptions are noted in your book. One, religious displays and religious expression by government officials, including teachers, etc. Could you address these two?
Religious displays, the jurist, we think that's up for kind of major Supreme Court intervention in this term, it's the American Legion versus the American Humanist case in this giant cross on public land. Our view about religious monuments and my current view about religious monuments is that when they constitute an endorsement of a particular faith or set of faiths, then they are inappropriately disparaging of other faiths and other individuals, and that they are unconstitutional. But what I think you're referring to is we think that we note that public officials, when they talk, are free to invoke religion, it would be an extraordinary State of the Union address that didn't and didn't end with, you know, God bless the United States, or some other religious invocation. And it's pretty clear that the general strategy of religious liberty in the United States is a pluralist one. It's the idea is to let, you know, to let 1,000 religious flowers bloom and try to keep the state from putting weight in this pluralist process, and try to keep the state from treating these flowers unfairly as they bloom. And that we've translated that to the idea that politicians are entitled to be themselves and say what they want to say when they're giving speeches. An executive order would be very different. A decision of the Supreme Court would be different. Congressional legislation would be different. And so we think there's something special about public figures and public candidates that is quite different than their official role. So the president is herself or himself up to the moment that they cross into some exquisitely official act. And at that point, you know, then we think questions of endorsement should attach.
Since you wrote the book over 20 years ago now, we've certainly seen a much more expression of minority religions and secularism. When you wrote the book, I don't believe we were getting the numbers in surveys of people who classify themselves as non-religious or spiritual but not religious or atheist, agnostic, whatever.
Right.
Speak to that landscape, if you will. What do you think we are seeing happening with the advent of religion, advent of a more of a presence in the public square, particularly among our elected officials? And before you answer that, I am reminded that sometimes people who are invited to give benedictions at the opening of state legislative assemblies and state Senate assemblies are met with protest because they are not of the majority religion. So I realize I've just kind of thrown a bit of a snowball at you, but if you can address that, I'd appreciate it.
Well, it's an interesting question. The sort of pluralist strategy that I described is a strategy that says, you know, we're not going to exclude religious pronouncements and religious sentiments from the public square. We're just going to keep the government from being a religious, you know, speaker in a formal way. That looks and works a lot better when there's a kind of, you know, religion's presence is one view among many, and it is moderate and moderated. But like so much else in our public life right now, the degree of political and in some instances religious contentiousness is getting very uncomfortable and making our ability to treat each other fairly as equals harder than it ought to be. But I don't think we should succumb to the temptation that, say, France has. The way France pursues religious liberty is to try to stamp religious expression out of the public square. So that, you know, the classic modern instance of the French approach is the banning of headscarves and burqas on the public street. That's just not the way we've proceeded, and I don't think it's the way we should proceed. The real problem is, to be quite explicit, I think we're in a period where our impulses to be civil and inclusive and generous to ideas and generous to beliefs is being, you know, that's being effaced. and it's being effaced by a series of circumstances, including, I think, the model of our national leadership. And that's really deeply unfortunate, but not, I think, a circumstance that the Constitution can be very helpful about. You know, it can't save us from the worst, our worst impulses. And these are our worst impulses, and they should be deplored. You know, some years ago, I was having a classic English high tea in a tea shop in Edinburgh, and was reading about the, you know, history of the English high tea. And it turns out that, you know, that it dates from the inclinations and leadership of Queen Victoria. And I think when our national leaders are modeling abrasive intolerance, it makes our worst impulses prominent. And it's not the whole story, but I think what we need is tolerance, embrace of each other, and inclusiveness. And that's our constitutional approach to religious liberty. It's to find ways to treat each other fairly and with respect.
Excellent final words, Larry, as we are down to the wire for this segment of Common Threads. I want to thank you so very much for your time with us today and last week as well.
It's been my pleasure, and I hope we find the occasion to talk again some other time.
I wouldn't doubt that. You've been listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and Professor Lawrence Sager has been my guest today from the University of Texas, talking about his book, Religious Freedom and the Constitution, something he co-authored with Christopher Eisberger, the current president of Princeton University. Please join us again next week right here on WGVU-FM for another edition of Common Threads.